We are here today to talk about Star Wars, and my guess is that for most of you guys, even if you're not fans yet, you've probably heard about Star Wars because it's big, there's merchandise everywhere, you pass by it, it's in the movie theaters, so on and so forth. So what I'm going to do, just to orient those of you who are new to it, to what I'm going to talk about, I'm going to give you a little bit of background on Star Wars, and if you want all the background, it's in source number one, so you can feel free to read more. But pretty much how it works is that this is an epic story of the forces for good versus the forces for evil. The forces for good are called the Jedi, and they're kind of knights. So when you think knights in shining armor, it's a little bit like that, but this is all set in outer space. And then we have the Sith, and the Sith are the forces for evil or the forces of dark. Pretty much the way that it's set up is there's something called the Force, and the Force is energy. And this energy is generated by people. It's what makes them be alive, and it's also all around them. And so people who are Jedi are able to use the Force, hopefully, for good and channel it in that way. And then people who are Sith are able to use the Force for bad. Usually to gain personal power, which is often bad, because it's only about them and it's not about anybody else. And the way that it works is that originally there was a Republic, and then the Republic was challenged, and there was this person called Darth Vader who tried to take over and make an empire, and he was happily not allowed to do so. But now it's many years later, and what's happened was there was the last Jedi, whose name was Luke Skywalker, and he is mysteriously missing, and they really need him because there's this woman called Rey, and Rey is Force-sensitive, which means that she has the power and the potential to become a Jedi, so she needs to find a mentor or a teacher. And then there was this other person whose name was Ben Solo, and he comes from Jedi and royalty is the equivalent. And so his parents are Han Solo and Leia Organa, who we could also call Leia Skywalker. And pretty much the deal is that he comes from this royal family, and so he has all this power running through his blood, and so he should be one of the most powerful Jedi ever and a force for the good. And he ends up being sent to be trained by Luke Skywalker, but something happens. It all goes bad. It all goes very, very wrong. And what ends up happening is that Luke then mysteriously disappears, and Rey, who needs training, is sent to go find him and try to bring him back because this person, Ben Solo, has converted into being a dark Sith Lord. So he's now the enemy. And if you didn't follow all that, that's okay. But the main thing to know is that Kylo Ren, who was originally Ben Solo, is a force for dark. He's a Sith Lord. And that opposing him, we have Leia, and we have Rey, and all these forces for good. So what we're going to explore here is Luke Skywalker as an educator, because his job was to train Kylo Ren, who was at that time Ben Solo. His job is also to train Rey, but for the purposes of today's topic, we're only going to deal with his training of Ben. And did he do a good job as an educator? And would the Tanakh and the Torah support his choice as an educator? So to start off with, we're going to go to Source 2, which is on page 2, and pretty much what ends up happening is this woman, Rey, who is seeking Luke's help, finds him, and she asks him, what ended up happening in terms of Kylo Ren, Ben Solo, like, what went wrong there? And so he says, "I saw darkness and sensed it building in him. I'd seen it in moments during his training. One time I looked inside, and it was beyond what I ever imagined. Snoke, which is another Sith Lord, had already turned his heart. He would bring destruction and pain and death and the end of everything I loved because of what he would become. And in the briefest moment of pure instinct, I thought I could stop it." So how exactly did he determine that he was going to stop it? In the course of the film, if you look at Source 3, there's actually three points of view of what happens. So the very first thing is that when Rey first finds him, Luke tells her that he saw Ben, his nephew, with that mighty Skywalker blood. In my hubris, I thought I could train him, I could pass on my strength. Han, who's the dad, wasn't fond of it. Leia trusted me with her son. I took him and a dozen students. I began a training temple. By the time I realized I was no match for the darkness rising in him, it was too late. So Rey says, "What happened? I went to confront him, and he turned on me." So the way that it sounds is very much like, his darkness just overtook me, and we were engaged in this battle. But later on, we get Ben's perspective of this incident, where he says he had sensed my power as he senses yours, and he feared it. And what you see in the scene is that Luke is standing over Ben with the equivalent of a sword raised. It's a green lightsaber, and it looks like he's about to strike. So Ben defends himself. And later on, Luke confesses to Rey the thing we had already said about I sensed it building in him. But then if you flip over to the next page, page 3, For the briefest moment of pure instinct, I thought I could stop it. It passed like a fleeting shadow. So what happens is he extends the sword. He figures he's going to kill his nephew, and in so doing, he'll eradicate any threat of that darkness and that evil coming to fruition. So he's got that lightsaber, and he's ready to do it. But then he is planning to stop. But the thing is that Ben wakes up before he stops. And so to Ben's mind, he sees his uncle standing over him with the equivalent of the sword, the lightsaber. And so what he understands, he doesn't know what's going on in his uncle's mind. He doesn't know that his uncle is supposedly about to stop. So when I was left with shame, this is Luke talking, and its consequence, and the last thing I saw were the eyes of a frightened boy whose master had failed him. So here's the question that I want to explore. Was Luke right? You know, we see that he claims that he regrets it, but sensing what Ben would become, was his desire to eradicate the incumbent threat not only appropriate, but actually moral? Because maybe you could argue that if you're sensing darkness in a person, and that person is going to bring about great, darkness, dismay, difficulty, and so on, the right thing to do is to stop them by whatever means necessary, and maybe that even includes killing. So in order to look into this further and see what would Judaism have to say about this topic, there are three Jewish narratives that I'd like to explore with you today. The first one concerns Avraham and Hagar's son, Ishmael. The second one concerns an innocent baby who's named Micha, who ends up being saved by Moshe Rabbeinu. The third one has to do with a confrontation between a king of Judah, whose name is Hizkiyahu, and a prophet called Yeshaya. Now, there is a concept of something called the Ben Zorer Moreh, which is the wayward child who's condemned for what he will become, but I want to argue that it actually doesn't apply, and so I'll explain to you why I don't think it applies. But we're going to start going through the narratives, and we'll go through them, and then I'll get your feedback and your ideas of how you think the narrative could be applied to the scenario, and go from there. So narrative one has to do with Avraham, Hagar, and Yishmael. And if you look at source 4, you'll see, I'll just, go in the English. Abraham took some bread and a skin of water and gave them to Hagar. He placed them over her shoulder together with the child and sent her away. She wandered about in the wilderness of Beersheba. When the water was gone from the skin, she left the child under one of the bushes and went and sat down at a distance, a bow shot away, because she thought, let me not look on as the child dies. And sitting thus, she burst into tears. God heard the cry of the boy. An angel of God called to Hagar from heaven and said, what troubles you? Fear not, for God has heeded the cry of the boy where he is. Now, before we go further, does anyone notice anything? You can look at the parts that I bolded that perhaps speaks to you or seems like an oddity in the text. Yes, they didn't hear her cry, but then he addresses her sadness. Right, so that's odd, right? It says that God heard the cry of the boy as opposed to the cry of Hagar, so that's a strange piece. What other things, if there are other things that you may notice in terms of the wording? And remember that when we look at commentaries on the text, the commentaries are always looking for these oddities. If there's something, like if there's a grammar discrepancy, if there's language that's left out, if there's language that seems to be additional. So what else might you notice here? Yeah?
The cry of the boy where he is.
Oh, okay. That sentence would have been fine if it had just said, fear not, for God has heeded the cry of the boy. Right? We don't need those words, ba'asher husham, where he is. Those words are not necessary for it to aid in our understanding. And there's a principle in Torah that we're not supposed to have extra language, that if there's extra language, there's a purpose to the language. So noticing those oddities, our commentaries, get to work and go, okay, let's figure out what we should do with this. So if you flip over the page, you'll notice we have a Gemara in Rosh Hashanah, and this is source number 5. So Rabbi Yitzchak said, a man is judged only according to his deeds at the time of his judgment, and not according to his future deeds, as is stated with regard to Yishmael, for God has heard the voice of the lad where he is. Although Yishmael and his descendants would act wickedly in the future, his prayer was heard and answered because he was innocent at the time. So that's really interesting. And then in Breish Yisrael, which is a Medrash, it also talks about this concept in more detail. And the first thing that it addresses is the point that you raised, which is, why is it that Yishmael's cry, the boy's cry, is answered, but not his mom's? So the efficacy of that is the first part, where it says where he is in his own merit. The prayer of the sick person himself is the most effective of all, according to this interpretation. But then where he is, so Rabbi Simon... Simone brings down this really interesting dialogue that happens. And here's the dialogue. So the angels come and gather before God, and they accuse Yishmael. And they say, God of the universe, a man who will in future kill your children, meaning the Israelites, with thirst, you're going to go and quench his thirst via a well? Like, it's not even that he'll be a killer. This is actually the method that he's going to employ. So God says to them, well, what is he now? Is he, you know, a tzaddik or a rasha? Is he righteous or wicked? And the angels reply, at this moment in time, he's righteous. So God says, I don't judge a man except based on Ba'asher Husham, where he is spiritually at that specific point in time. So in case you're wondering, do Ishmael's descendants ever actually fulfill this threat that the angels claim that they do? If you flip over the page to page 5, and you look at sources 7 and 8, you'll discover that according to these interpretations, they do. So in the book of Yeshaya, we have this pasuk of the krat sameh hetayu mit mayim yoshvei eretz tema belachmo kidmu noded. So Rashi on this pasuk says that what happened was, it's customary to bring water, but you, and this is referring to the descendants of the Ishmaelites, they not only did you not bring water, but this is what you did. You brought really salty food to, you know, the person, pretending like you're going to be their friend, but then they were parched with thirst, and what they had done is they had these sacks that they had blown up full of air. So when the person would try to drink, they would inhale the air instead of the water, and so the air would go into his innards and he would die. So this is really macabre description of this horrible death that the Ishmaelites end up inflicting upon the Israelites later on. And yet, despite all of that, God claims that it's only fair to judge that boy at that moment in time in terms of the actions that he has at that moment. So I'll ask you guys, if we were going to try to take the story of this and apply it to what we've got going on in terms of Luke Skywalker, and should he have raised his lightsaber to eradicate his nephew Ben at that moment, what are your thoughts if we're applying the text, this text? Then no? Yeah?
Except, was he innocent if he saw the darkness already in him?
Okay, so this is a really important question.
Evil?
Right. What does it mean to see the darkness in a person? Does it mean that it's simply swirling around and that he still has the potential to choose one way or another and that the decision hasn't been made yet? I just have more source packets, so that's locked in. Or does it mean that in order to have done something, because the word used here has to do with deeds, like actual actions, is it that it's not enough to simply have darkness swirling in you and thoughts maybe of doing something that would be considered wrong or evil, but that you actually have to have taken an action? And so we'll have to keep on reading to look at the other texts and see if we can figure out how it might apply from there. So the second narrative has to do with Micha and Moshe. So I'm going to give a little bit of background to this story. Here's what happens. Moshe, as you guys know, is the famous savior of, you know, Bnei Israel. He takes them out of Egypt, and then he brings them through the wilderness, and they wander around for a long time, and then eventually, they get almost to the promised land, and so on and so forth. He has a lot of adventures with the Israelites. So what happens first is that God tells him and Aharon to go to Pharaoh and to ask Pharaoh to give them leave, to go on a 3 days journey into the wilderness and to worship God there. And there's a lot of questions about what was intended. Meaning, let's say Pharaoh had said yes to that journey. Would they then have simply used it as a pretext to flee and to escape? Or was the logic that slowly, if Pharaoh would have been kind enough to allow them that 3-day excursion to go worship, then perhaps they could have worked with him to eventually get to a place where he would allow them to go. And different commentaries have different readings of what would have happened. But the point is, Pharaoh did not say yes. And in fact, he said quite the opposite. He said, you guys must have a lot of time on your hands if you're busy sending people to me to send delegations that you want to go have prayer parties in the middle of the wilderness. So I'm going to make sure that you don't have time on your hands anymore, and this is how I'm going to do it. You have a certain quota of bricks that you're supposed to be making and laying for me. What I'm going to do is take away the straw that we've been providing to you until now, but you're still going to have to match that quota of bricks. So as you can imagine, that's very difficult because in the same amount of time, they have to go find the straw and the mud and whatever was necessary, form the bricks and build it and meet the quota. So Bnei Israel are very upset about this, and they feel like, you know, Moshe and Aharon, they claim and they promise that we're going to have salvation and freedom, and instead look at how our lives have become miserable because of them. So you get to this pasuk, it's source 9, page 5. So Vayashav Moshe el Hashem, Vayomar, right? Lama haraotam la'am hazeh, lama zeh shilachtani. U'me'az bati al paro l'daber b'shmecha, hayra la'am hazeh, v'hatzel lo yitzav la'atamecha. So he says, oh Lord, why did you bring harm upon this people? Why did you send me? Ever since I came to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he's dealt worse with these people, and still you have not delivered your people. So Moshe is calling God out. He's like, this is not okay. So then the Medrash once again in source 10 explains what was Moshe so upset about. What does it mean that you haven't delivered your people? So one interpretation could mean you haven't delivered your people, meaning you had said that we were all going to be let free, and what ultimately ends up happening with the story of the Exodus that we tell over every Passover. But another interpretation that Rabbi Akiva brings is he says, I, meaning Moshe, know that in future you will save them, but in the meantime, when they're not meeting their quota, their little children are being cemented and placed between the bricks, right? So in lieu of the bricks and the straw, we now have little bodies that are filling the spaces. So that's horrific. I mean, obviously there's many pieces that are horrific to the Pharaoh story, the fact that the you know, little baby boys for a period of time had been thrown into the Nile and so on. But this is very disturbing. And so we get to, you know, this is bothering Moshe. Moshe's a compassionate person. And for those of you who have learned through Shmuel before, one of the things that we see is that it's not just that Moshe comes and God says to him, okay, go be a savior. He does things before then that demonstrate his sense of justice and his sense of compassion. So, for instance, he stands up when he sees that there's an Egyptian man who's beating an Israelite to death. And when he sees two Israelites fighting, he intervenes between them. And then finally, when he has to flee and escape to Midian, and he sees the daughters of the shepherd being harassed, he protects them as well. So that's his nature. You know, he's a protector. He's a compassionate person. So it makes total sense that the Medrash would take that nature, how he's depicted, and say, here, he's really disturbed by the little babies being used in place of bricks. So then we get to Sanhedrin, which informs us, it gives an explanation of people's names, and it talks about someone called Micha. This Micha is someone who was crushed in the building of the storage cities of Pitom and Ramses and was miraculously saved. Well, how was Micha saved? So that comes to source 12. And what happens is that Moshe and God have a conversation. And God says, I'm sorry, Moshe says, you're harming the nation because now these babies are being crushed. God says back, these individuals, meaning the children that are being built into the walls, are thorns among the Israelites. It is revealed to me that if they were to live, they would be completely wicked. But if you wish, you can devise a test, save one from the bricks, then let's see what will become of him. So Moshe's like, all right, I'm going to test that, you know, premise. And he decides to save this person called Micha. Now, what becomes of Micha? We all want it to be this wonderful story where Micha gets saved from the bricks and he lives a fantastic life and he's a great guy. But unfortunately, our texts don't support that reading. If you get to text 13, we have this story of the golden calf, which, as you know, is one of the low points of Israelites' saga, in that here they just had the revelation and they've had Har Sinai and they should be so close and connected to God. But instead what happens is that when their intermediary between themselves and God, which is Moshe, seems to be late coming down the mountain, according to Rashi, they instead make this molten calf to be their intermediary. And there's a lot of charitable ways to understand it. It doesn't have to be that they were truly worshiping the calf. But at the end, there are some who say, I'm on source 13, that Micha, the idolater mentioned in Judges chapter 17, was there, who had been drawn forth from the foundations of a building in Egypt. He had in his possession a plate upon which Moses had written Aleph Shor. What had happened was that Joseph's bones, according to this Medrash, had been sunk in the Nile River. And Joseph had made everyone promise that his bones would make it to Eretz Yisrael. So Moshe had written this tablet, Aleph Shor, he had thrown it in, the bones had miraculously risen, and that's how they were able to take the bones to be buried later on. Micha comes into possession of this, he throws it into the fire, Aleph Shor, out comes the golden calf. So he's, you know, the originator of this horrible sin. Then we have the story in the book of Judges about Micha as well, where he says to his mom, this is the source 14 on page 7, the 1,100 shekels of silver that were taken from you, you know, let's take them. And so he ends up making this sculptured image with it. And not only does he make this sculptured silver image, but he then employs this Levite to go be a priest to it. So in both of these instances, he's sowing idolatry and sin amongst the people. So now the question is, okay, if we were going to look at this scene with Micha and Moshe, how would we then potentially look at the Luke Skywalker and, you know, Ben Solo, Kylo Ren thing? What do we think should be done? If we're going to apply the story.
Well, it's complicated because you have a child. You've got the baby. Mm-hmm. Like, do you want to be the one who's killing the babies? Like, well, we know down the road, like, he's going to be bad. Like, he hasn't even had a chance to live yet. Mm-hmm. And so it's a very tricky thing of other people kind of sealing the fate of people without them, here in this case, not even getting a chance to live in that sense.
Good.
That's the big moral conundrum that's covering.
Yeah.
It's also different between a man saying, oh, this person's not going to be good, and Hashem telling us with certainty this person's not going to be good.
Ah, okay, so that's something I really want. I want to underscore that, because that's going to come up in our next narrative as well. Right here, God has told Moses, I see, you know, with all my omniscient divine power, that these children will not grow to be, you know, good for the purpose of the nation. Which is, as you mentioned, different from, you know, Luke Skywalker, a Jedi, someone who is fallible, someone who is human, with everything that comes with being human, making that determination. And perhaps then we could say that that's the difference, you know, when it comes to what God might determine versus what man might determine. But we'll see in this next narrative. So we've got narrative number 3 that has to do with a king called Hizkiyahu and a prophet called Yeshaya. So here's what happens, the basic story in, number 15. Right? So Hizkiyahu falls dangerously ill. The prophet Yeshaya, son of Amos, comes to him and says, this is what God says, set your affairs in order, for you are going to die, you will not get well. So Hizkiyahu turns his face to the wall, prays to the Lord, and says, you know, I have actually been a really good king, and this is actually very impressive, because if you learn the book of Malachim, and you learn the stories of the monarchy, both monarchies, you know, both that of Judah and of Israel, the vast majority of their kings become corrupt in various ways, and especially when it comes to idolatry and turning aside from God. So Hizkiyahu is very much the exception to the norm in being a good king who disseminates Torah. So, you know, I've been a good king, and I would really like you to help me out here and not kill me, right? So please, Lord, remember how I've walked before you sincerely, wholeheartedly. I've done what's pleasing to you, and you. So before Yeshayahu has even left fully, God says, go back and say to Hizkiyahu, the ruler of the people, thus said the Lord, the God of your father David, I've heard your prayer, I've seen your tears, I'm going to heal you. So at this point, what we know is that he got sick and that he gets healed, but we don't know any other pieces to this story. So whenever we have situations like this, as you know, the Gemara, the Medrash, the Agadata loves to fill in the pieces. Right here we have a really righteous man who seems to have gotten the death penalty from God, but for what? But why? This isn't a clear-cut case of someone who was worshiping idols and God said, well, you were worshiping idols and therefore you deserve death, right? This is something else. So we have to figure out what is the something else. And that shows up in source 16, which is the Gemara from Brachot 10a. So Hizkiyahu says to Yeshaya, what is all of this? For what transgression am I being punished? Yeshaya says, because you didn't marry. Okay, seems odd. Hizkiyahu says, this is the reason I didn't marry. I had divine inspiration, right? I had Ruach HaKodesh, that my future progeny would be evil, right? Any child that I have would be destined for evil. And because of that, I decided it would be better for me not to marry and not to have children as opposed to siring a child who would bring evil into the world. So Yeshaya says back, and this is the part that's bolded, why do you involve yourself with the secrets of the Holy One, blessed be He? That which you are commanded, which has to do with the mitzvah of procreation, having children, that is your job. It is not your job to determine what may come of your child down the line. So Hizkiyahu says to Yeshaya, if you really believe that, you give me your own daughter as my wife. Perhaps with my zechut and your zechut, my merit and your merit, we will have virtuous children. So what ends up happening is, you have a king of Israel who's super righteous, that's Hizkiyahu. You have a prophet of God who's super righteous, that's Yeshaya. The king of Israel marries the daughter of the prophet. You would imagine from such a union with all of these very holy and righteous individuals involved, you would have great role models, you would have, you know, great examples, and that the progeny of that, all that they would ever see would be goodness and righteousness and that it should all go well. It doesn't. So the interesting thing is, by the way, that this is not the first time it happens. Some of you may be familiar with the story of Eli, which shows up in the book of Shmuel, where Eli's sons end up corrupt. You see it also with Shmuel, who's a very dedicated prophet of God. His sons end up becoming corrupt. And we see it with Hizkiyahu, too. So that's a different discussion of why is it that sometimes you have people who are seemingly so righteous or so good, and yet their children deviate from them. Various answers have been offered. Two of the ones that immediately come to mind, there's one that says that simply when you dedicate so much of yourself to the community, it can be difficult to be in the parent role as well. So a lot of these people, these are people who are serving. You know, Eli is serving as Kohen Gadol and Shofet. Shmuel is also, he's a Navi and he's a Shofet. Hizkiyahu is a king, right? So, you know, it might be difficult possibly to be there for the child at the same time. But the other thing is that sometimes what happens is that when someone is born into a legacy like that, that can also be very difficult. Because you're born into the shadow of these great, great people. How will I ever live up to them? It might be easier for me to deviate, even if deviating means being wicked, and have my own story. And the reason I think that this is particularly significant in what we're looking at today is because Ben Solo is the child of that kind of royalty. Like, Ben Solo's parents, Leia and Han Solo, these are the people who were instrumental in saving the whole Republic back in the day and in making sure that the powers of evil and the powers of the Sith were not successful in overcoming. So you would assume that their child, Ben Solo, born to them, should grow up with the best role models possible, much like Chiskiyahu and Ishayahu's daughter. And as we see, it doesn't always work that way. So flipping over, you look at 17 in Malachim Bet. Menashe was 12 years old when he became king. He reigned 55 years. His mother's name was Hephzibah. Now, in English, a lot of people make fun of this name, Hephzibah, but the Hebrew is actually really beautiful. The Hebrew Hephzibah, it means, like, my desire is for you. It means, like, you know, like someone who's very, like, you know, wanted and loved and so on. Anyway, so Menashe does what's displeasing to the Lord. He follows the abhorrent practices of the nations of the Lord. He rebuilds the shrines his father Hizkiyahu had destroyed, erects altars for the Baal, makes a sacred post like King Ahav had done, bows down to all the hosts of heaven. You know, he builds altars for all the hosts of heaven in the courts of the house of God. He gives his son to the fire, to Molech. He practices soothsaying and divination. He consults ghosts and familiar spirits. He does so much that's displeasing to the Lord. He goes on and on. I mean, all of this is, you know, and if you look at the part that's bolded, they did not obey. Menashe led them astray to do greater evil than the nations that the Lord had destroyed before the Israelites. Therefore, the Lord spoke through his servants, the prophets, because King Menashe has done all these horrible things, all sorts of bad things will happen. And then at the very end is this nice little addendum. Moreover, Menashe put so many innocent people to death that he filled Jerusalem with blood from end to end, besides the sin he committed in causing Judah to do what was displeasing to the Lord. So if you're reading this, it really sounds like Menashe was a horrible person, like a terrible human being. And we really might struggle with understanding why Chizkiyahu was considered at fault to not want to bring this man into the world. Right? You would think that he was doing the noble thing in choosing not to marry and choosing not to have this child. And one, there's a couple pieces I want to bring up. One is a source I didn't actually bring here, but it's an interesting source in the Gemara, where there was a teacher who was teaching, one of the sages. And he referred to King Menashe without respect. He didn't say King Menashe, he just said Menashe, like it was his buddy or something. And so then King Menashe comes to him in a dream and starts expounding Torah and just explaining all of these things that this sage was unfamiliar with. And so then the sage is confused and says, if you knew all this, like if this was so easy for you and you had all this ability and knowledge, how then could it be that you did what you did? And so King Menashe replies back to him and says, if you had lived in my time period, you would have lifted up the skirts of your robes to run to commit idolatry. So the point of that Gemara is to say, you know, it's very easy to judge these people when we're not living in their times, we're not living in their context, in their historical context, we don't have the same desires that they have. Idolatry in and of itself can be difficult for us to understand. Some people argue that it should be seen as maybe almost an addiction, where, you know, it's less of a, it's easy to judge, you know, something where we would be less judgmental of and we would be more understanding of. So the point is, even when he has done all these evil things, he's still someone who deserves respect. He still should be referred to as King Menashe. But moreover, something interesting happens that is brought up in Divrei Hayamim and not in Malachim. Now, there's many reasons for why there are discrepancies between the books of Divrei Hayamim and Malachim. One simple reason is who wrote them and what their purpose was. So, you know, in our tradition, the author of the book of Malachim was Yirmiyahu. Yirmiyahu lived through the destruction, and therefore his ultimate goal was to get Bnei Yisrael to see, you know, the monarchy experiment failed. It didn't work out. These people ended up really evil and taking us away from what they should have, kept us on track of doing. And therefore, you know, it was through our sins that the destruction came about, and we have to repent. And that was the message of his book. In contrast to which, Divrei Hayamim was written by Ezra and Nehemiah, and these were people who were trying to effect a return to the land of Israel. So they wanted to talk about how Jewish sovereignty was a good thing, much like if you're going to look at Nefesh v'Nefesh and, you know, try to consider the view of whether you should make Aliyah or not, they're going to be showing you all the really positive reasons to move to Israel. It's not their job to show you, oh, here's all the reasons you might not want to come, right? Every organization has its mission. So, you know, for Divrei Hayamim, they're trying to show how it was a good thing, and they either try to gloss over failings of the kings or to talk about what went well. So this shows up in Divrei Hayamim, and we find out in source 18 that when God causes the officers of the army of the king of Assyria to take Manasseh captive in manacles and bind him in fetters and lead him to Babylonia, in his distress he entreats the Lord. He humbles himself greatly. He prays to him, and God granted his prayer, heard his plea, and returned him to Jerusalem. And then Manasseh knew that the Lord alone was God. After that, he builds the outer wall of the city of David, and he does all these things. He places army officers in the fortified towns of Judah, removes the foreign gods. So this is mind-blowing. This man who was described as so evil and so irredeemable, at least according to the text in Divrei Hayamim and also in the Gemara, does teshuvah. And granted, he's not able to undo 55 years of evil with that teshuvah, but it shows that at least on an individual level, this man is redeemable. And if Hizkiyahu had simply decided, I'm not going to have a child, as was his original plan, there would never have been hope for him as an individual to go through this process. And the Gemara says something really amazing in source 19, and it's the part I bolded. Is it conceivable that Hizkiyahu, king of Judea, taught Torah to the entire world, and to Manasseh, his son, he didn't teach Torah? Rather, Hizkiyahu certainly taught Manasseh much Torah. Nevertheless, from all his exertion to teach him, and from all his toil to teach him, it was only afflictions that elevated him to the path of good. And I think that that's also really important, because I think that this is something that happens even within, let's say, our community or any community. People will look at, you know, a kid who is not doing things the way that other people think the kid should, and they'll be like, well, the parents, you know, the parents might have raised them wrong, or the parents weren't good role models or something. That's not the case. You know, there's different kinds of people, there's different kinds of kids. And so, like, this is demonstrating that, you know, Hizkiyahu was a great dad. Of course he taught Torah to his son. It didn't work for his son. It was through pain that his son was finally able to rediscover God. You know, people have different ways. Of course, no parent wants their kid to be in that position, and no parent wants their kid to come to that place through pain. And, you know, it's not desired, but that is what happened. You know, that was his journey. That was his story. Okay, so if we come to this story, right, with Hizkiyahu and his very noble and righteous parents, and, you know, going back to our original question of what do we think Luke should do, dealing with Ben Solo and the darkness inside him, and we were going to try to apply this text. What are your thoughts on how we might make, what determination would we make from this?
Well, he's redeemable, at least at that point in time, because he hasn't done anything yet.
Okay, exactly, right? There's darkness swirling in him, and as far as Luke thinks that his choice is made and that he's going over to Snoke, which is a Sith Lord, but as you mentioned, he hasn't yet done anything, and so that's actually raised accusation against Luke. Oh, did you want to say, I'm sorry.
No, but his grandfather was redeemable.
True. So there's the potential. We go through the storyline. This is just for those of you who know about Darth Vader as a spoiler. But yeah, Darth Vader is redeemable. He does teshuvah. It's a great moment. So, all right, Rey's accusation against Luke. So this is what Rey says to Luke after Kylo Ren has explained to her his version of events. And his version of events is that Luke saw his power and that he was afraid when he saw his power, and that's the reason that he lifted up the lightsaber to kill him. It had nothing to do with, you know, darkness or light. It just had to do with personal enmity. And so Rey says, is it true? Did you do it? Did you create Kylo Ren? Tell me the truth. And then a little bit later she says, you failed him by thinking his choice was made. It wasn't. There is still conflict in him. If he turned from the dark side, that could shift the tide. That could be how we win. So she, you know, from her understanding, from her, you know, speaking with Ben, you know, she believes that this is actually Luke's creation, that Luke, in lifting the lightsaber, took a person who was conflicted and who was having thoughts of joining the Sith as opposed to the Jedi, but she made him, you know, Luke Skywalker, made him go over that edge because it was kind of like, well, he's trying to kill me. He already assumes my choice is made. So in that case, like, let me save my life and go over to the ones who will defend me. Okay, so then there comes this concept of Ben Sora Amora, or the wayward son. And I'm going to argue to you that I don't think it actually applies. You are welcome to disagree with me. So we have this concept of Ben Sora Amora, where it says, if a man has a wayward and defiant son, he doesn't heed his father or mother, and doesn't obey them even after they discipline him, the father or mother can take hold of him, bring him to the elders of his town at the public place of his community, and say, the son of ours is disloyal, defiant, he doesn't heed us, he's a glutton and a drunkard. Thereupon, the men of his town shall stone him to death. Now, at first glance, this seems like a very, very disturbing section of Tanakh, right? You know, especially nowadays. Like, we live in the world of all kinds of, like, you know, freedoms and adolescence, and, like, if every single kid who was defiant to their parents suddenly was stoned to death, then it would be very problematic for our community and our world. And just so you know, I work with teenagers, so, like, those are my people, that's my crew. So, you know, we would be disturbed if this was actually how we did things. So what's going on with this passage? What is really happening? So the rabbis legislated this passage pretty much out of existence. They read it so carefully to come up with all the stipulations of what had to happen in order for it to happen that they make the argument that it actually never happens. So I included all of it. We're not going to read it all, but for those who are curious, source 21 is this long episode in the Gemara that goes through how, you know, he doesn't even become stubborn and rebellious unless he actually eats the meat and drinks the wine. If it's any other food, but it's not meat. If it's any other beverage, but it's not wine, he's not considered a Betzor or a Mora. Right? Then he has to say that they have to be, I don't know the order of this, but it has to be like of one voice. Like it says this thing about how the parents, the father and the mother will take hold of him. It talks about how they actually have to physically look similar to one another. And it goes through all these things to say that this didn't happen. So the most important piece is that he has done something. What has he done? You know, he's done this thing where he's stealing from the parents and that he's eating, and it comes up with specific amounts of what is considered how much meat he has to eat and how much wine he has to drink in order to be considered a glutton and a drunkard. And then the question is, okay, so let's say he did all these things. We're going to skip over to source 22, which is on, you know, page 20. What's going on? Why is there this logic that this Betzor Amora is supposed to be put to death? So there's this remark of the Iyun Yaakov that the heavenly court can punish based on the present, like we saw with Ishmael, like how is he now, Ba'asher Husham, but the human Sanhedrin has to eliminate the Betzor Amora because of the future. What might be the reason? Because Hashem can always know where someone is at, right, but, you know, which is the case with Ishmael. However, with Betzor Amora, the Sanhedrin has to act when they're given the legal opportunity to do so. Since the boy has already begun behaving in an abominable fashion, and there's ample evidence right now that he will continue this way, he must be dealt with properly. You know, maybe later he'll assault people and murder them for their money. No witnesses will be present. And the human Sanhedrin can't say, don't worry, all you potential victims out there, we know exactly when to execute this fellow. We'll be certain to be provided with sufficient legal evidence at this time. So there's this requirement to judge him now. But I think that the most important piece of all of this, in terms of the Betzor Amora, which I think is significantly different from Kylo Ren, is that he has acted. Granted that the actions are minimal in comparison to, like, nowadays, what we know, okay, he stole, he's a glutton, he's this. But he's done something, as opposed to Kylo Ren, who's simply described as having this darkness swirling within him and having thoughts about joining Snoke. These are thoughts. You know, Luke is trying to execute him potentially based on thoughts. And that's why I think the other narratives, which are about people who haven't done anything yet, are more applicable to the story that we're dealing with than this one is. But I'm open to, you know, being challenged on that. Okay. Where does Luke's action leave Kylo Ren? The short answer is it leaves him incredibly angry. There comes a scene at the end where Kylo Ren is on his ship. He sees Luke appear, and he says, I want every gun we have to fire on that man. And the commander hesitates, and Kylo Ren says, do it. And they begin, and he goes, more, more, and he gets, like, crazy. It's a great scene. You can watch it. Right? So the commander's like, you know, do you think you got him? And then Luke's still standing after all of that. And Kylo's like, we can finish this. Sir, bring me down to him. Keep the door covered and don't advance till I say, Supreme Leader, don't get distracted. Our goal is... So Kylo chokes him right away, sir. So then he spits at him. Did you come back to say you forgive me? To save my soul? And so Luke says no. So here's what I want to talk to you about. My reading of this scene. If Kylo Ren or Ben Solo had really made up his mind that he was joining the forces of evil, then for Luke to try to attack him, it would make sense. You know, like, his decision was made. Luke is on the forces of good, which is the Jedi. Kylo's on the forces of bad, which is evil. Luke attacks him. It's not personal. It's just Jedi versus Sith, as it always is. But he's taking this whole scene super personally, and the argument that I want to make is the reason that he's doing that is because he feels mistreated, and the reason he feels mistreated is because he has been misjudged. And we know what it's like to be misjudged because the famous episode of a lack of fair judgment comes up with Alien Khan. Where, you know, Hana is pouring out her soul because she is in so much pain, and Ailey understands that to be that she's drunk. It, like, it couldn't be a further reading from the truth. So here we have Kylo Ren, the child of this, you know, royal couple with all this power in his veins, conflicted, right? Should he be on the side of evil? Should he be on the side of good? He doesn't know. Where should he end up? and Luke just judges him. Luke just decides, well, you're evil. I've determined it. I'm taking out my green lightsaber. I'm ready to kill you. So the anger that he has in this scene, I feel, is not indicative of someone who had he had made his choice and I'm just mad at you because you tried to kill me, because there wouldn't have been that personal, like, there didn't need to be. I think the extra anger is there because he was misjudged, and I want to back that up with, did you come back to say you forgive me to save my soul? You know, this is just a battle of light and dark. You don't need that sentence. Like, this is, you know, you thought you were so high and mighty that you could judge me, that you could determine my worth and my value, and I'm really, really upset about that, and that's why I'm going to focus all of my energy and attentions of getting rid of you, you know, who I see as this person who just was so cruel to me. So, coming back to this, we were looking at Luke as an educator. Now, I do think it's important to note that an educator is much more than their one mistake, right? Because, you know, as a teacher, I know that I'm going to make mistakes with my kids, and obviously it would be unfortunate if my entire, you know, teaching career is going to be judged just by one mistake. And so we do see Luke later attempts to educate Rey. That could be a whole separate cheer, what he does right and wrong with her. But what does it mean for us as educators? So I have a couple sources here that I want to go through. The first is from Rabbi Soloveitchik. And Rabbi Soloveitchik says that it's not implausible to link the verb amen, which is like from amen, from belief, emunah, to the word em, which is mother, because she is the foremost teacher of the believer and the child. A mother will never despair of her child, nor will she spare any effort to further her child's welfare, even though she doesn't expect to live long enough to enjoy the fruits of her child's sacrifice. She is the most unselfish being. Her faith in her child will never be shaken, which, by the way, in the film, his mom, who's Leia, we see it happen. Like, we see that Leia ultimately and completely believes that, like, he is redeemable. She sends her husband to go try to bring him back. So, like, it's exactly what it says here. Right, to believe and to bring up are identical accomplishments. The believer must be able to engage in a great educational task to pick up the debris of a shattered world. You know, the element of faith is indispensable for any pedagogical endeavor. A teacher, this is really, really important, who lacks confidence that his pupil is able to grasp the ideas he passes on to him will never be successful. The teacher must have faith that learning will have a moral impact upon the disciple. Knowledge is redemptive, therapeutic, and therapeutic performance. A pessimist must never do any teaching or be entrusted with the care of a child, since his efforts are doomed to failure from the very outset. I cannot underline that more. Right? If Luke doesn't believe that he has the power to persuade Ben Solo that Jedi, you know, the Jedi way is better, that being a force for good and for the light is better, then he's not the right mentor for him. He should not be involved in his education at all, right? You know, that's just the wrong approach. Then we have Rabbi Kalonimus Kalma Shapira, you know, from the Piyasesna Rebbe, Chobos HaTalmidim, and I want to skip down to the part I bolded, which is on the next page, page 23. Even if some children seem rebellious or flawed in their character, the teacher must know that the nature of soul seeds of unripe angels is to taste bitter as they're ripening and to be filled with nectar in their maturity, which is the same as with fruit, right? You have an unripe fruit, and then eventually it's nice and juicy and it's delicious. Neither the nature nor any particular quality of a child is absolutely evil. This is what the Holy Baal Shem Tov and his disciples have taught us. What is necessary is just to know how to use these qualities and how to help them develop and grow. For example, a particular child may be very stubborn, which is a character flaw. His teacher may suffer greatly because of the child's stubbornness. But if the teacher were to reflect, he would realize that when this child matures and receives as his own the yoke of Torah and the service to God, he will perform all his service of God with great stubbornness and self-sacrifice. He will not be frivolous or inclined to vacillate, but he will be the kind of Jew the Medrash describes. In all matters of devotion, he will be as strong as the wall of a fortress. So, going back to Ben Solo and Kylo Ren, there was conflict in him. He was really weighing the odds. You know, should I be with the Sith? Should I be with the Jedi? But if he had then ended up on the side of the Jedi, how strong would he then have been? Because he would have weighed both sides and he would have made a choice. And once the choice was made, he could have been this incredible force for good. In preempting him the way that Luke did, he robbed him of that opportunity. And he pretty much pushed him in the direction of going to where towards the Sith, who were considered to be much more accepting. I'm just turning off my timer because it's going to ring in a minute. Mm-hmm. So this last bit, Mishpacha magazine, you guys may have been maybe aware of Mishpacha, Bina, Ami, all these magazines. They published a story that was actually amazing, where this person wrote about his experience in yeshiva. And he was in a yeshiva, but he did something that was a little unusual for a typical yeshiva bachur in one of these more frum and Haredi places. He was an artist, and so he drew a lot of pictures. And so every so often, there's no real privacy in such an institution. They found his artwork, and the Rosh Yeshiva gave this searing lecture to the entire Beis Medrash, where he talked about how there's this one bachur who thinks that he's so holy and he's so pure, but really he spends his time on frivolous things like artwork and all his Torah is worthless. And as you can imagine, that killed the kid. I mean, that hurt the kid deeply, and he didn't know what to do with that, and he eventually was like, well, if my Torah's worthless and my Rosh Hashiva doesn't value me, and like, where do I go from there? And he had a really, really, really bad experience. And so eventually, though, he did choose to come back, and this thing is written in the article that I thought was beautiful. There's two different types of Jews. There's Matan Torah Jews, and there's Megillas Ros Jews. You know, a Matan Torah Jew lives on a very high level. He's a Jew who learns Torah day and night, who's attached to Hashem with all his heart, but in spite of all his greatness, he still can't bring Mashiach. Mashiach will come from a Megillas Ros Jew. Mashiach comes from Rus because Rus taught the entire Jewish people that the greatest achievements come after a person has been pushed away, after he has been asked to leave. She taught us if you come back after you've been driven away, after you've been shamed, and you still cling to the Torah, then your Torah will become the Torah of Mashiach. Your name is David, he went on. David HaMelech also contended with shame and rejection. From the time he was born, he was denigrated and humiliated, but that made him a vessel for the most profound devotion that ever existed. You know, we all think Shavuos is the holiday of the Jews who have a connection to Matan Torah, but I tell you it's really a Yom Tov for the Jews of Megillas Ros. You should know that when a person comes back after he's been driven away, he's a different person. He isn't coming back for external reasons, right? Someone who was misjudged in such a way doesn't come back to Judaism because there's some nice kugel and some great shalins, right? They come back because they've decided that the religion is true or meaningful or that they have a connection to God or that there's something that they haven't given up on yet and that they want to make it better, right? It says that's the power of a Megillas Ros Jew. So, let's going back to Ben Solo and Kylo Ren, right? The third episode has not yet come out, but I think that there's a really important piece in this Luke and Leia's last encounter. Luke tells her, I came to face him, Leia, and I can't save him. And Leia says in this very dejected fashion, I held out hope for so long, but I know my son is gone. And Luke says, no one's ever really gone. And so my belief, you know, this is my prediction right here, is that I don't think Kylo Ren / Ben Solo is gone. I don't know that it's going to be the exact same story as we had with Darth Vader. I think that they're going to try to change it up for us a little bit. Maybe he'll end up dying or, you know, who knows. But I think that there's going to be something there. There's something in him that we haven't seen the last of yet. So, and in the end, my takeaways from these narratives that we've explored, right, you have them listed here, right? We must judge people as they are at that point in time. Only the Almighty can do otherwise. No matter what we think we might know, our obligation is to do what we can to help nourish and nurture others. It's entirely possible that people that we thought were irredeemable might return. One should not educate or teach if they do not believe that they can be effective. I cannot state that more strongly. And one must be careful not to judge others before they have even acted. Right? When I see this all the time. People look at a kid, they're like, well, you know, that kid, you know, with the tattoos, or that kid with like that look, or that kid with the short skirt, that kid must be XYZ. You know, that kid is not XYZ. That kid is just a kid. Leave the kid alone. Right? Recognize that someone's nature or character flaw may become their greatest strength or asset. So here we have the story with Star Wars. It actually connects really well to a whole bunch of stories in our Tanakh. It was a pleasure to be with you today. Enjoy your next session. Yay.